Welcome, everybody, to Mentality Monsters. We're doing something a little different this morning. I am kicking us off today, and today we are going to talk about soccer. So the U.S. men's national team is playing another leg of their World Cup qualifiers this week, tomorrow, in fact. And I'm excited about this because the USMNT is actually good, which we haven't been able to say for a long, long time. So, Kyle, I've been saying to myself that it's only a matter of time before the U.S. becomes a major player on soccer's world stage. The sport itself has been growing tremendously in the U.S. because of the MLS's expansion, powerhouse European teams playing friendlies in the U.S., and what I think most importantly is because streaming services and TV networks are making leagues like the Premier League and the Champions League and other like top flight European leagues more accessible in the U.S. And I also think that because those play times slot into like Saturday and Sunday mornings before football actually starts, that soccer has created a little bit of a niche for itself as a sort of warm up to these American pastimes that are much more established in our culture. It seems that right now we've reached a point where American soccer players can A, become famous both in the US and abroad, and B, make generational money. So now that European clubs are pulling talent from the U.S. into, you know, England, Germany, France, that is a major, major boon in players' ability to earn a lot of money over their careers, which is not something they could do in the U.S. today. And these two factors, in my mind, are the things that are infusing so much talent into the sport of soccer as a whole. And then you combine that with the fact that America is a country of 300 million people. It has a high school sports system that is not present in Europe. And by sheer numbers alone, we should be dominating this sport, which we haven't been in the past. And it looks like we have the opportunity to in the next couple of World Cups. A lot of people talk about this team as a golden generation of our national team soccer. And the thing that makes it even more exciting is the fact that the team's average age is 24 years old. The roster has a lot of highly talented, internationally recognizable names. The coach seems to know what he's doing for once. It is definitely an exciting time to be a USMNT fan. And I personally have always been a bigger fan of the international competitions because from my perspective, they're a lot easier to follow and they're generally higher stakes. So this is especially exciting for me because while I've always been a fan of Croatia and been able to root for Croatia in the World Cup, I was born there. My family came from there. They're really like the only team that I could root for because the U.S. never qualified. I always thought personally it'd be a lot of fun to see the U.S. in the tournament because an engaged and an energetic U.S. fan base is always a fun time. And there is an element of like, I want to be able to cheer for my home team because the U.S. is my home and it would be awesome to see them represented in such a big world stage. The U.S. plays El Salvador tomorrow night and Canada later in the week. And the game against Canada is a really big one. So in preparation for these games, I thought it'd be fun to talk about the USMNT and dig into them a little bit more, dig into soccer as a whole. And it just so happens that Kyle here knows a lot about soccer. So what we're going to do this time around is we're going to interview Kyle on everything that he knows about soccer, especially the USMNT, so that we can understand, and I personally can understand, why this team feels so special.
First thing I want to do is rewind the clock back to 2016. The U.S. hosted what was called the Copa America Centenario here domestically. And the Copa America is your regional version of the World Cup for South America. And this was a pilot for the U.S. hosting a major tournament here domestically, and also the possibility of having the South American Federation and the North American Federation host a deeper and more interesting continental tournament. And the U.S. made it to the semifinals where they played Argentina in Houston, Texas. And for those familiar with American football, there's a movie that came out about a half decade ago called The Blind Side. Have you seen The Blind Side?
Yes, I have seen The Blind Side.
Well, the spirit of what takes place in The Blind Side and to Michael Orr is that football presented an opportunity for him to make it out of a difficult situation. And this is so often the case for a lot of athletes. I mean, tune into the NFL draft on ESPN and they just eat up all of the stories of, yep, this person came from a broken home, a broken neighborhood, and he's about to make millions of dollars and live his dream. And what was very clear when the United States was on the field with Argentina at the same time is the Argentine players treated that ball like it was that thing for them, that they have had that their whole life. That's been the only consistent thing that was there for them since they were born, and it pulled them out of rough situations and on the streets. And you can see how much it meant to them. They didn't want to let the U.S. win a single duel anywhere on the field. The way they stood over the ball, the way they treated the ball, to them, it was the thing that allowed them to pull themselves out of tough situations and make it in the world. And the U.S. didn't have that. However, I would say to this point, the U.S.'s best player or most prolific player in history, Clint Dempsey, does have a very similar story to that. Down in Texas where he grew up, soccer was that thing for him. And so he was able to use the sport to pull himself out of a tough situation. And he had that same sort of mentality that the whole Argentine national team had at the time. And so I think that the United States is now farming talent. As you said, there's an opportunity to make money. There's an opportunity to go and also achieve some degree of fame as a player in the sport. And I think that teenagers going over to Germany, I was watching an early season match in the Bundesliga between Gladbach and Bayern Munich, and Gladbach had a teenage left back named Joe Scally from Long Island, and said he lives by himself in an apartment like 30 miles from the stadium in Gladbach, and the word is going on about how mentally tough this individual is. He chose to leave his family and his entire living situation and his country behind. He lives by himself in Germany just to have a chance at a career in this game. And I think that the level of fortitude it takes to do that and the sacrifice that these players are now making in order to build a successful career in this sport is head and shoulders above what it was a half decade or a decade ago.
And it's important to note, because we've touched on a couple of times, players going from the U.S. to these European leagues. And before, I'd say 2 or 3 years ago, that transfer from the U.S. to these European leagues was always a joke. You had guys like Landon Donovan and Clint Dempsey, who were like these legendary U.S. national team players who carried the team in all their tournaments, would go to Europe and get obliterated and would return after a couple months because they couldn't cut it in those leagues. The only player on the U.S. that actually did for a long time was Tim Howard.
Because goalkeepers in general.
Yeah.
Like such Brad Friedel played for Tottenham, and we've always produced good goalkeepers. But yes, Tim Howard, he did really well for a long time.
Right. And now what's happening is these Americans that are going over the league to these European leagues are being successful in the leagues. They are playing meaningful minutes. They're contributing in meaningful ways, scoring goals, defending how you need to defend. And that is translating into a more talented and effective national team.
Yeah. And the teams in Europe are eager to get Americans now. That they see that it works and it's successful. I mean, it's particularly popular to get them over into the English Championship, which is one tier below the Premier League. There's a consistent cycle of loans going out from MLS to there. Those teams are buying players. Yeah, you see it, again, across Europe. It's really common that Americans will get their start in Germany. That seems to be a league that's a successful farming setup for American talent. You know, we've been doing it for a while. Weston McKennie got his start at Schalke before he moved to Juventus, the biggest team in Italy and one of the top most recognizable brands of soccer in the world. So, yeah, there's a significant difference in the way that the game is viewed in households here in the U.S. and for this generation from a young age, where they feel a genuine connection to it and believe they can make a living off of it. They believe they can achieve notoriety off of it. And what we're seeing now with this collective group in the national team is all guys who've cut their teeth in Europe and done it. You know, I would say without the European leagues or teams reaching to get them, that they legitimately believe that that's going to be a signature piece of them moving forwards, and they're treated, you know, well over there in Europe. So that's all coming to fruition now. And the U.S. had their most successful year in 2021 that they've ever had. Really, they've were able to beat Mexico three times in a calendar year for the first time since the 1930s. They won two continental tournaments, and they are now sitting 1 point off the top of the CONCACAF World Cup qualifying group with an opportunity to secure that berth in the World Cup this year in Qatar in November.
Why is it such a shame that the U.S. hasn't participated significantly in the World Cup up to now?
Well, I think there were two runs that they made within World Cups in 2010 down in South Africa, and they were able to actually win a knockout stage game. Landon Donovan with a late goal there, you know, biggest moment in U.S. soccer history. And then in 2014, they made it to the World Cup in Brazil, and their group was Portugal, which featured Cristiano Ronaldo in his prime and won the European Championships 2 years later. Germany, who won the World Cup that year and was universally the best team. And then Ghana, who was the team that they went against in 2010 that they knocked out. And Ghana hates the U.S. because of that. And they're a tremendously athletic team with lots of players that play globally. That was considered the group of death, and the U.S. got out, where they were knocked out by Belgium in the knockout stages right away. You know, it was going into that, the attitude around soccer in the U.S. was that, you know, it's a pipe dream that the team could really advance far or really do anything in the tournament. And I think we're seeing more and more countries in different international tournaments able to really strategize and have a team structure that allows them to advance far in that tournament. It's not the same format as club. It's a one-off games. Team like Iceland in the 2016 Euro, they really got to know each other well. They had a fantastic, what they call set piece routine, where they would throw the ball into the box from wherever they would get a throw in. So it was effectively like a corner kick, and teams weren't expecting this and they didn't know how to defend it. And they were able to advance and even win knockout stage games. So I think that gave a lot of other countries some hope that if they could form a nice team structure, regardless of talent level, that they could advance really far in one of these tournaments. So I think the U.S. has had an eye on that for sure. And that strategy by the U.S. and seeing how other countries were able to do it successfully, coupled with the presence of players playing at a higher level week in and week out in Europe, has really led to the U.S. having a shot that they've never had before. And I think, you know, growing up generation, you know, millennials and then Gen X and boomers, soccer wasn't really a, you know, dinner table discussion. It wasn't really a part of the fabric of the culture. So it's hard to say we are going to be high level achievers in this, but it's not something that you really care about, right? I was joking with people when we were watching the World Cup that Americans have no interest in something where Ghana could beat them. Like, just get back to us when we're the best, right? Like, you know, in track and field, we dominate in the shot put because it's the least technical and it's all about raw strength and all that. But things that are like the discus and the javelin that are technique based, we pale in comparison to these other countries that really know how to invest in that and really care about that. And so, yeah, I think Americans, you know, when a World Cup comes around, they're like, oh, what's up with this? And then it's like, well, you know, Ghana could be better than us. And I think it's just like, all right, I'm not into it.
What makes the World Cup so special?
Most watched sporting event in the world. It's like the world stops turning, you know, when the games are on. You know, it's a fight to always host the World Cup between different countries. And it's, to say it's the most watched sporting event, I mean, it's something like 10x, you know, what the Super Bowl is. I mean, even more than that. And so it's really unique, too, in that it's not like the Olympics where different countries might specialize in different sports, right? The Germans never lose in you know, downhill, you know, bobsledding, and Dutch are fantastic at speed skating, and Americans dominate in Olympic basketball. It's one sport. And it's an intimate sport too, because you can see everyone's face. You know, you get to form a connection, you know, with these individuals, because they're also from a build standpoint, they look like one of us, so to speak. It's one of the reasons why Steph Curry revolutionized basketball so much, because every player in their youth felt like, I could be Steph Curry, when you look at his physique and you look at his build. And so we look at soccer players and they're these young individuals and they're not these monster like offensive linemen, and you can see their face. There's like a connection there that gets built, I think. And that's the case in every country.
The fact that the tournament happens every 4 years increases the stakes.
Yes.
And the short lifespan of a player's career, which is compressed even more so than a typical athletic career because it's once every 4 years. In reality, as a player, you probably have three good World Cups in you if you start playing on the national team at the age of 20.
Right.
It makes the impact of the contribution of those players so much more significant when a tournament goes a certain way. Like, Croatia made it to the finals in the last World Cup. This was like mind-blowing that a country of 4 million people could produce a team that was good enough to make it that far in the tournament. And their players, when I went to visit family after that World Cup, I think it was a year or two after the World Cup happened, there were still billboards all over the capital city about this golden generation of players that took the country to these heights that no one ever thought was possible. And that weight adds a lot of drama and compelling storylines to the tournament itself. And then on top of that, you have like rivalries between countries that also spice things up in a meaningful way.
Yeah. I saw a really funny, it was on Twitter in 2014, the semifinal was France against Germany. And somebody was like, damn, I was really hoping for a matchup with a little more World War II history.
Yeah, that, especially in Europe, because Europe is a very nationalistic region. Like,
yeah,
you know, there's the European Union that supposedly unifies all of Europe. But at the end of the day, like, Europeans care about their country first and foremost, and they're very prideful and very nationalistic about where they come from. And so when those European teams especially compete against each other, it is awesome to watch.
Yeah, you know what was funny? This year, the European Championships happened, and it came down to England against Italy. And, you know, the English goalkeeper was making, like, hand signs, like he was talking like an Italian every time he made a save. And I was like, wow, these teams really don't like each other. and then one of the English players said he would dye his hair blonde. If they make the whole team do it, if they 1, and there's a player, Jorginho, on Italy, who he plays for Chelsea in England, and he dyed his hair and he showed up for his club like, oh, I thought we were all doing this. Like, what's up? So, yeah, they really don't like each other over there.
What is so important about the games that the U.S. is playing this week, and what happens after these games?
Yeah, they have a chance to, not mathematically, but we'll say secure a spot in the World Cup if they win all three. I believe they would need 11 points to guarantee that they make the World Cup, and they can pick up 9 by winning 3 games. So they play Canada, who's leading the Federation standings right now by a point over the U.S. Play them on Sunday. They play El Salvador, and they'll play Honduras next week. So they can do a significant amount of damage in securing a World Cup berth, which is in November, which would mean that they would be sweating that in the next qualifying cycle, which is in March. So they would have that damn near wrapped up with a chance to start to solidify and crystallize their starting 11 for the World Cup, now, and start to focus on that as we head into the summer, and then obviously the World Cup in November.
Let's talk about the thing that Americans care about most, which is star players. Every team in every American sport is buoyed by these recognizable faces and characters, and they're the ones that get all the media attention. They're the ones that answer all the tough questions, that are given the ball in those moments that matter. Who are the stars on the USMNT that the audience should be aware of and would be interested in, most interesting to follow over the course of the next couple of months?
Yeah, I think that, you know, we love prolific scoring and, you know, we love scoring. So Christian Pulisic is somebody that he's been successful at it for the national team, and he's been successful at it for his club team as well for a number of years. He was really the first really, really significant American presence in Europe where we knew it was going to be a success. He'd done well in Germany. He went to England, huge club, Chelsea, one of the biggest, you know, Chelsea has the resources to get whoever they want, whenever they want. So for him to go there was, you know, a huge moment for the U.S. However, I think the key to their team is really the midfield grouping of Tyler Adams and Weston McKennie, as well as Yunus Musah. Adams is someone who plays for Leipzig, RB Leipzig in Germany. And he's really I like to use musical analogies when I talk about the sport. He's really the metronome of the team in that he's dictating the pace. He's the player that will turn defense into offense. And similar, you know, Luka Modric does this for Croatia. That's the most important position in the sport, in my opinion. The player who has to have the mind for both the defending as well as the offensive side of the game. So I think Tyler Adams is the key piece to the team. And then, you know, Weston McKennie and Yunus Musah are two guys who, let's focus on McKennie for a second. At Juventus, he was someone that Cristiano Ronaldo took under his wing and really took a liking to and showed him the ropes and you know, effectively made him his mentee. Just the way that he approached the game, which, as we know, Ronaldo is like a Tom Brady with the way he approaches his fitness and the game in general. And so Weston McKennie, someone, he's got goals in him. You know, he can make runs from different areas of the field. He's not scared to take someone on, you know, run at them, and he can find a knifing pass that breaks the defense. So he's got a lot of potential to be a playmaking type personality in the World Cup for the U.S. And a bit different is a Yunus Musah. He plays for Valencia in Spain, and he's someone that also likes to get at the defense to run and take people on directly. Quadratti against Real Madrid game. And obviously Real Madrid is one of the premier brands in the world. They're a team that's annually tipped to win their league as well as the Champions League. And, you know, Musa was the guy that early in the game, Valencia was running their whole scheme through to try and break down Real Madrid. And they had a really good spell for the first 20 minutes. So they're watching this. I'm like, this is amazing. Like, this team is using an American guy to try to break Real Madrid spirit. And that was really similar to the Joe Scally, you know, watching him at the Gladbach in Germany and thinking that he's 18. This was really just a moment where I thought we really have something here, and it would be, and we have some amazing potential as a team the next decade, really. So those three, Adams, McKinney, and Musa, exciting players, particularly McKinney and Musa, who can pass, they can run at people and then take that defender out of the game and do some exciting things to get the ball to the likes of Pulisic. So I'm really looking forward to that trio. And in my opinion, I hope Berhalter, the coach, picks all three of them together. I think they have tremendous potential.
The thing that fueled Croatia's run to the World Cup final was a golden generation in the midfield, coupled with a dominant goal scorer up front in Mario Mandzukic. And it's interesting to me that it seems like this U.S. national team is built in a similar way, where you have that midfield with Weston McKennie, Tyler Adams, and Yunus Musa dictating the pace of the game and where things are distributed. The midfield is very similar to, in basketball, the point guard position, or I'd say in football, like the quarterback position, where you're distributing the ball, especially on offense, to all of the players that need it. You're really the starting point for the execution of the offensive game plan. The other thing too is the Americans have Ricardo Pepi and Christian Pulisic, who are very good goal scorers, like natural strikers that, you know, these are the guys that all they focus on is shooting the ball at the net, and they get really good at scoring goals. So I, for that reason, I have a lot of confidence in where the USMNT is going to go.
I think it would be really interesting if the U.S. were to lean more on Pepi for goal scoring and use Pulisic as the right term is not really a decoy, but well, so we see a lot of teams that in Europe have a lot of success in breaking down other teams when they pull, let's say Harry Kane does this often for Tottenham, and then for Real Madrid, Karim Benzema is arguably the best in the world at this. They pull that presence, the real threat, a little bit further up the field, and it sucks the defenders towards him, and then he passes it off because there's so much more open space to somebody like a free runner, like a Pepi, who I actually think is more, I should say he's more lethal than Pulisic. Pulisic has done very well, you know, in situations where he has a chance in on goal. I think Pepi has more potential in that situation. So it'd be interesting to see if they play off each other that way. I think Pepe's more of a straight out-and-out forward, and Pulisic a winger, obviously. I think he'll draw a lot of attention from defenders when he gets on the field. So it wouldn't shock me if they use that strategy and, you know, come the World Cup.
Pepe is more specialized.
Yes,
he is really good at doing one thing, and that one thing is scoring goals. And there's a lot that goes into scoring goals, like positioning yourself in the right spots around the goal and making sure that you're able to convert the opportunities that you have. Pulisic is much more dynamic in that he can be both a pure goal scorer and a creator, which is why the strategy that you are advocating for is, it makes sense to me. To put it again in basketball terms, like Pulisic is very much a scoring and passing point guard, like the way that that Steph Curry is. Like Steph Curry will get 45 points, but he also has the capacity to get 20 assists. He performs based on what the game needs of him. Whereas you have someone like a Bradley Beal on the Washington Wizards, who is just like a pure point scorer, or like Devin Booker, pure point scorers that they're put on the court to just score baskets left and right. And that's the dynamic between Pulisic and Pepe. And that's why that strategy would be interesting. And Pulisic gives you another layer of creativity from the midfield into the forward positions to allow you to attack those defenses in interesting ways. I agree with everything you've said. I think it's their makeup as a team is really, and then you also have Serginho Dest, who's on the defensive side, who has the capability to move up into the offensive portion of the field and add an attack capability while not sacrificing defense, and can mark the best player on the other team effectively enough to slow them down.
Yeah, I think it's Dest is a little bit weak in terms of his defending, and he's, you know, he's at Barcelona. Xavi came into that team and he took Dest out of the team. So Dest could be on the move actually, if he wants to get playing time now somewhere else. Nonetheless, you have a guy from the US who's young and he's starting for Barcelona. That's unheard of. That's ridiculous. That being said, I think the strategy that the two best teams in the world over the last 5 years employ, they're a little bit different. Manchester City and Liverpool, nonetheless, they love to get the wide defenders into the offensive attack to cause problems for the opposing defenders, who are now choosing between whether to come tight to them or come tight to the natural offensive player, and they all have the same ability on the ball. So it becomes very frustrating, and they really rely on their two central defenders to take out any counterattacks. So they have extraordinarily good central defenders. Again, for purists, it's an oversimplification of those two teams. I know that there are differences. I don't think the U.S. has that strong of central defenders, so I would be wary of how much fullback play, how much, you know, wide defender play comes up into the main area. I think Dest is great for that, but I think they would be wise to keep three back because I don't think they have as strong as central defenders.
Who is the captain class player on the team? We talked in one of our first episodes about the captain class book. It focused on these unsung heroes that are contributors on the team in a way that doesn't always translate fully on the field. And oftentimes in soccer, the examples that the book gave, the captain class player was a defender or someone that you wouldn't see prominently handle the ball throughout the game, but was really critical to the cohesion and the execution that the team displayed in their competitions. Who's that player for the U.S.?
Yeah, I think Tyler Adams, for sure. You know, Leipzig is a team in Germany where he plays that historically they really, really like to do what's called a high press, which is when they lose the ball, they like to run at the player who just got it and try to get it back as quickly as possible. And so the key to beating that is to, you know, be able to pass really quickly. And then you're effectively, you've got the other team beat because all their guys have come tight to the guy who just had the ball and he passed it. So Adams is somebody who has effectively functioned as a cleanup crew type role for that team. So when things break down and the press doesn't work, he's charged with sweeping and following the opposing attack, you know, as a deep midfielder. And then when it's ultimately won back by Leipzig, starting things back up again. So I think he's had a lot of experience in chaotic situations because that team is, you know, Jurgen Klopp calls it heavy metal football. In German, it's called Gegenpressing. You know, so there's a lot of chaos that goes on in the game that employs that, with a team that employs that strategy. And so I think I just think the world of him, and I think he's got a ton of ability and the right mentality to go with it. He scored in a Champions League knockout stage game 2 years back to push Leipzig to the semifinals. So, you know, he's also got experience in big moments.
So he's the glue guy.
I would say so. I would say so for the U.S., yeah.
What about the coach? In the last episode, we talked about the four pillars of a great coach. As a reminder, the recognition of a player's ability with respect to results, mutual recognition of the team's mood, mutuality of purpose, and mutuality of values. Does Greg Berhalter embody those pillars?
You know, I thought about that, you know, independent of whether Berhalter himself had ever really applied it. I think this is the year to see, because when you get with a national team, there's not as many matches and not as much practice time to implement as there would be for a club where you'd be able to see in like 2-3 months, or, you know, in American football within a couple months of your season, you know, 1 year in, really, whether or not this person possesses that. However, this summer, he was able to navigate the U.S. to winning multiple tournaments, beating Mexico in the finals, and then beating Mexico in World Cup qualifying, again, 3 times in a calendar year. The U.S. and Mexico, obviously, they're rivals, and they battle it out for the title of Gigante de la CONCACAF, the giant of CONCACAF. And even Mexico would even concede that, yeah, the U.S. took the title of Gigante de la CONCACAF from them this year. And so I think doing that under his tutelage, winning those tournaments, perhaps we downplayed those tournaments in the past and, you know, really only tried to focus on the World Cup, and that didn't work out for us. So I think he injected a bit of spirit to those tournaments and those situations. So the team was, it's like when a team needs to make the playoffs, they need to win in their final game. They talk about having that momentum when they get in against a team that had been resting. So effectively, we've been playing at a high level for the whole year leading up to the World Cup. So I would tip my cap to him. He's familiar with the American format. He, you know, a lot of punditry in the sport looks down on MLS and the usage of MLS players. I actually think the league has advanced tremendously. There's consistent flow of players going from MLS to Europe. And even now, if you see, there's teams playing in the Africa Cup of Nations that have tons of players from the MLS. I believe it's Cameroon that has 2 defenders that play in the MLS. You know, one of them on the Philadelphia Union. Again, there's real international talent, a lot of South American talent as well in the MLS. And so he's not afraid to pick players from that league. He's confident in the players from that league, which is a big deal for us because it is our domestic league. And, you know, the goal isn't to say, you know, we want everybody to be in Europe. However, I think there's a really good balance of that right now in the team. And he's picked a lot of MLS players for this qualifier because I think it's their offseason, and he was able to have a longer training camp with them and lead up to these qualifiers. So there were some European players he left off, like Josh Sargent, plays for Norwich City in England, and he's done well recently. He's not named in the team. The English clubs have been playing a whole smattering of games late in the year, early into the new year, whereas it's the offseason for MLS, and so he called in Jordan Morris, who had time away with injury, and I think he wants to give Morris a shot, and he wants to have a full camp with him. And the fact that the team is able to, you know, rely on this strategy is a huge plus for them. So it's a long way of saying I think Berhalter, the results speak to what he's been able to do, and 2022 will be a big year for him.
The thing that I've observed about him in watching the past few qualifying games is that he is not afraid to make adjustments on the fly.
Yeah, I do agree. Game management, he's done all right with that.
Which in soccer is really... So in soccer, you have a limited number of substitutions, and the way the game flows is a manager effectively sets the strategy and sets the squad that's going to go out on the pitch, and it's up to the players to execute that plan. And so the coach has very limited ability to influence or change how a game is flowing by making a few key substitutions or key adjustments. What I've seen with Berhalter is that he makes substitutions in moments where
it's actually possible to influence the game. So it's typical in a soccer game to start substituting players out around the 70-minute mark. Berhalter is willing to do so earlier. He's willing to put certain players in that completely change the way that the U.S. is attacking or defending. And he does it based on the feel of the game. I also like that he changes his lineups from game to game, especially based on the opponent. That is something that I haven't seen as often with some of the more established teams, because those European teams or the South American teams, they have their starting nine. And those are the people that are going to play no matter what, it seems.
Yeah, so neglected to mention this earlier, in the CONCACAF Gold Cup win, you know, and their other continental tournament win this year, they were able to win playing different styles and managing different game situations. So while it can be boring, there's value in a team having the fortitude to sit in and allow some pressure and then play on the counter. Fans want to see the team play more open, which they did when they played Mexico in the 2-0 win in Ohio in November. So they are able to play with different styles, and as you alluded to, also with different lineups. And I think that's a tremendous testament to him, when perhaps something that's underrated. They've had a few slips in some World Cup qualifying matches that they should have won. But overall, the ability in those moments, you know, extra time, penalties in these tournaments over the summer, 1-0 wins, grind it out. That's how you advance in tournaments, how you advance in World Cups and win. You got to be comfortable in those situations. It can't be you've got to be an amoeba to a degree as a soccer team. You got to be able to fit in different situations and be comfortable with that. The other team is going to get pressure on you at some point. There's an emotional flow to the game, and the U.S. has done a much better job managing that, as far as I've seen, than in the past.
What do you think is going to happen in the next couple of months? You think the U.S. is going to qualify? And then if they do, how do you believe they will fare in the World Cup?
I think they'll qualify. I think they will qualify. As for how they'll fare, I know this is hedging my bets. I think it really all depends on the group and the schedule. You know, Croatia had this taste of this experience in 2014. Let's say you go up against the host country in the first match. It's like you're going to get a really tough game there. I mean, even though it's Qatar, they know the world is watching and they've been waiting for this for like 5 years. And so there's a lot of different things that can happen. Let's say you play the best team in the group. You know, let's say they're in a group with Brazil. If they play them last and Brazil already advanced, do they bring the same level of intensity, and can the U.S. sneak out a result? There are so many factors to who advances and when in a World Cup that it's really hard to say.
So you heard it here first. The U.S. will win the upcoming World Cup.
We do host the next one, 2026.
That one's going to be exciting. We have to go to a game. God.
Multiple. I'll go all over.
Hell yeah. Let's go back to, as we start to wind this down, let's go back to those players that we talked about a little bit earlier. How do you envision the U.S.'s talent faring in Europe and other leagues around the world?
Really well. They've got some big months coming up. Brendan Aaronson playing for Red Bull Salzburg. He's got some potential to move to England. Leeds United possibly bidding on him. If he stays, they play Bayern Munich in the Champions League. He's got a chance to show what he can do in one of the biggest matches in the world, globally for the year, from a club perspective. You know, Pulisic, obviously, he's not a lock for the starting 11 at Chelsea. Again, Chelsea has an army of, you know, probably 30 players who could start in there. An unbelievable academy. So he gets playing time, you know, from time to time. He scored against Liverpool. So he doesn't shrink from the moment. He's competent there. you know, Ricardo Pepi, you just moved to Augsburg in Germany. He had a couple of options. According to him, you know, Augsburg really made him a priority, and he really liked the way that they laid out for him that he would fit in there and make him central to their plans. So I think as long as the players are consistently going to situations like that and looking out for, you know, their playing time as well as the overall structure of the team they're going to, right? So, I mean, a Zach Steffen from a goalkeeping perspective, he's not starting every week at Manchester City, but he gets to play under Pep Guardiola. He gets to play for a team and for a scheme that the goalkeeper is effectively an outfield player. He gets to learn to play with his feet, do a lot of different things, and read counterattacks early. I mean, Manchester City is going to say, we dare you to try to score against us. And so the goalkeeper has to read that, you know, that counter really early. And so he's seen that in practice every day. He played cup games. And so I think it comes down to whether these guys can find themselves in a situation where they go to a club with fantastic structure and management, or where they're getting a lot of playing time. And I have every reason to believe they'll continue to be successful if they do that.
What do these players need to do to put themselves in the best position to succeed?
And for the national team, club, both?
In terms of country, the club specifically, like tying back to that question about those players that are going to be in Europe and who's going to fare well, like what does it take to go from the US to Europe and be successful?
Yeah, the proper management of expectation, there is a lot of expectation that comes with who's in your starting 11 at certain clubs in Europe. You know, there's a kid, Martin Odegaard. He's Norwegian. He moved to Real Madrid. He was supposed to be, you know, as a teenager, you know, this incredible talent. And I think, you know, he was there 2-3 years. They loaned him out. And, you know, he left the club because, I mean, effectively the fans ran him out because he didn't live up to the billing. He played at Real Sociedad for some time, and then he moved to Arsenal. And he's doing really well at Arsenal. And I was listening to an analyst, and it was a really interesting moment. The analyst's name is Jan Agafjørtoft. He's Norwegian. He covers the Bundesliga, and he's talking about Odegaard. And he said, in the United States, athletes are not considered to hit their mature stage until they're like 24 years old. So it was interesting that they were looking at like American football or basketball to say like, okay, perhaps we're judging these guys too early. And so I think for American players, you want to get into a good situation when you're still a teenager or early 20s. And you want to be in a situation with the proper expectations. Dortmund, where Pulisic was, notoriously fantastic for developing talent at that age and having a great academy. So I think, you know, big move situations, big money situations to big clubs can bring heavy expectations. And that can be a challenge. I mean, Josh Sargent, he was on Werder Bremen in Germany, and he moved to Norwich City. They're in a relegation fight in the Premier League, and as a goal scorer, that pressure gets ratcheted up when you're not winning the games right away. He'd only been there for a few months, and you know already he was starting to feel some heat. And he had an amazing game this past week. He scored, you know, a brace to win that game for Norwich, and it could go a long way in them staying in the Premier League. So he was able to navigate some of that early pressure there. So yeah, I think it comes down to expectations and managing those and getting into a situation with the right ones.
How do you think the US MNT's games are going to play out this week? First against El Salvador and then against Canada?
The expectation should be to win all three. I think it was deliberate that they are choosing to play the first one in Ohio and then next week's in Minnesota, where let's say El Salvador and Honduras are not really used to those conditions. They've had a good camp, good team called up, and Canada's missing Alphonso Davies. I think the U.S. will have a little something extra on that game because they are upset about tying to Canada at home in Nashville in September. So I think the U.S. should expect to win all three, perhaps draw one, but I think they should come away with at least two wins.
And then what happens if they get that result? Are they at the top of the group? Like,
if they beat Canada, they will be. Or take any points off Canada, they will be. Yeah.
Awesome. All right. Well, the first game against El Salvador is tomorrow night. And I know I'm going to be excited to watch it. I know you are as well. We'll probably be texting each other back and forth during the entire game. Any closing thoughts?
And just an exciting year for the sport. Exciting next five, you know, with the U.S. hosting in 2026. Give it a shot. Like Fed just said, slots in real nicely before your American, you know, more traditional sports. Wake up, cup of coffee, and watch the Premier League. Some huge matches coming up in the next, you know, 2 months. Champions League as well, February, March. Give it a shot. I love the game. You know, after having American football be my first love, it's a great sport.
There's something peaceful and calming about the green grass and the sunlight hitting it on a Sunday morning when you're likely hungover and waiting for American football to start. That's the episode for today. USMNT preview before these upcoming qualifying games. And we'll continue to talk about these sports and what they mean and what the players do to be successful on these teams as they come up. So if you like this show, please like, subscribe, tell your friends, leave a comment. Comments bring us to the top of the search results in the app stores. We really appreciate you guys listening, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you for listening.